This episode is brought to you by Adobe XD. Adobe XD is the collaborative platform for experienced designers to design and prototype engaging user experiences. Stay tuned to hear how XD helped me make a product I'd been trying to get greenlit for nearly 4 years possible. Yes, 4 years. Picture yourself on a flight 30,000 feet above sea level. It's a night flight, so the cabin lights are dimmed. Movie's playing. And you have a 1.5-year-old at your feet throwing the worst tantrum you've ever experienced. All of a sudden, well, your cortisol levels are already through the roof. All of the lights and the power in the aircraft immediately shut off. Imagine the sheer terror you feel in that moment of just thinking, oh my God, is this the end? And then all of a sudden to hear on the loudspeakers, the flight attendant, several moments later, after the lights have actually returned, say, ladies and gentlemen, we apologize for that inconvenience. We lost ground power for a moment there. But never fear, everything's okay now. Everything's okay now. So imagine that, and this is a true story. This happened to my wife and I about 15 years ago. And the point of the story is to tell you that the lights immediately shutting off is not a design, is not by design. In fact, when you get in an airplane and you get to cruising altitude, if it's a night flight, the system is designed. Somebody, an empathic designer, had the sense to go, wow, if I were on an aircraft and the lights just immediately shut off, I'd be terrorized. So an empathic designer said, this is not the right convention. Let's make this better. Let's design this with empathy for the passengers so that the lights will dim slowly, very slowly, when you are getting to cruising altitude. That's how I wanted to kick this monologue episode off. This is the second monologue episode, and it's all about the important topic, and this is one of my favorite topics, of empathy. Specifically, empathy is a design superpower. You know, I believe that any life and world-changing product or service was built because a designer had the empathy to build it. I just mentioned the airline, just the aircraft analogy. That's something that, unless you're really paying attention or unless you've really been in a situation like my wife and I, where our aircraft, the power literally shut off for a few moments, you know, it's just one of those little details, those little big details that you don't really notice. But I want to draw your attention to the fact that if you look around, if you really pay enough attention to any product or service that's built genuinely for you, the user, the human on the other side of it, if it's changing your life in some way, if it's impacting your life in some positive way, I can guarantee you it's because a designer had enough empathy for you to design it that way. And maybe it's because they themselves or someone close to them needed it, right? There's an expert out there who says that designers aren't users. I'm sorry, not sorry, but we are users. In fact, I think some of the greatest products have come from designers who needed it. So there's also an influencer who will tell you that they believe empathic design is impossible. And I tell you, you're dead wrong. And my goal in this second monologue episode is to prove to you that empathic design is not only very possible, but it's essential in creating impactful designs. So what is empathy? Well, Merriam-Webster's definition is the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts, and experience of another, of either the past or present, without having the feelings, thoughts, and experience fully communicated in an objectively explicit manner. In other words, it's all but literally putting yourself in another's shoes. And what I'm going to tell you what empathy is not. Empathy is not sympathy. And I'm going to let Brené Brown, who is a wonderful author, defenders, designers, UXers. If you haven't followed Brené Brown's work, definitely check it out. I feel like it's required reading for any UXer. She is so tapped into the power of empathy and vulnerability and authenticity and shame. And so highly recommend her work. She got a nice spotlight recently on Netflix, I think, with a documentary or something. I don't have Netflix anymore because I think they hate my kids, but that's another story for another day. But anyway, it's neat to see her getting that exposure there. But I'm going to let her explain the difference between empathy and sympathy, because I think nobody says it better than her. Check this out.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you climb down. I know what it's like down here. And you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
After hearing that explanation, amazing explanation from Brené Brown, I want to also talk about mirror neurons. You don't hear about this as much, but mirror neurons are really, really fascinating. And these were discovered in the early 90s by an Italian scientist. What this scientist did was he placed electrodes on monkeys' brains, and he did not give that monkey a banana, but he allowed another monkey to peel and open and eat a banana in front of that monkey with the electrodes. And it's so funny, the monkey who did not have the banana had parts of his brain light up as if he was peeling and eating the banana. And that's so fascinating. We just got chicks recently, and it's so funny to watch them when they're super hungry and I'm filling up their feeder with some chicken feed. It's so funny to watch them after I get it in there. They're like eating it like they've never had a meal before, or like it could be their last. And it's just so funny to watch because there's like 10 or 12 holes that they can stick their beaks in to get the feed out. But each one, it's so funny to watch, and I should probably video this and maybe try to share this, but they will actually, even though they have one perfectly good hole right there to get the feed out, they'll kind of look at what the other chicks are doing, and then they'll be like, hey, maybe there's something better in that hole that they have, and then they'll try to stick their beaks in their hole. It's just, it's really funny to watch. But I realized that after kind of researching some of this, I realized this is mirror neurons at work. They're actually feeling what the other is feeling. They're trying to emulate that as a tribal creature as well, as a herd creature in this case. So that was really interesting for me. And there's another experiment with the mirror neurons that is really fascinating. And it's actually quite sad too. It's known as the still face experiment. And it was done by Dr. Edward Tronick. I'm going to share a video of that, and listeners, you'll hear the audio, but I'm also making this a video, which will probably may even be a more compelling experience because of some of the clips that are going to be in here. But it's so interesting that babies even will feel empathy for other crying babies, and they'll start crying because they are feeling that pain. So that's another example of a mirror neuron. But check out this video. It's super sad. But it proves a really valid, important point here.
Babies this young are extremely responsive to the emotions and the reactivity and the social interaction that they get from the world around them. This is something that we started studying 30, 40 years ago, when people didn't think that infants could engage in social interaction. In the still face experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby, who's about a year of age.
I'm like a girl. Oh.
And she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her.
Yeah.
This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this. And then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points because she's used to the mother looking where she points.
Yeah.
The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening here?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother, like, "Come on, why aren't we doing this?" Even in this 2 minutes, when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually may lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing.
Okay. I'm here. And what are you doing? Oh, yes. Oh, what a big girl.
It's a little like the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is that normal stuff that goes on, that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still face, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly situation.
So that compelling, right? And also kind of sad. It's so sad to see the mother turn away from their baby, and just kind of like, and then turn back with just a complete emotionless state on their face. And I also think about like some of the sociopaths, some of the serial killers and such that have existed. And I will almost be willing to bet anything that they grew up in an environment that lacked empathy, severely lacked empathy, and severely lacked the proper affection from a loving parent. I'm almost willing to bet anything that they did not have that. And so they felt like their entire existence, when they needed that nurturing and they needed that fostering, that they didn't have it. And there was just some sort of emotional breakdown that started occurring from a very early age. That's why sociopaths, I mean, they cannot feel empathy. It is impossible. I think there's something to that. So, but I also want to talk about movies, because why do we go to the movies? It's the mirror neurons. We don't think about this often, but we want to feel what the characters on the screen are feeling, right? And we can experience that when we see them acting, and we know they're acting, but yet it feels so real when you get the camera angles, and when you get really good actors, and when you get the soundtracks behind it, and it's really moving. Like, okay, you saw Endgame, right? By now, I think most of you have seen Endgame. If it didn't get dusty in the room for you at the end, check your pulse, right? I mean, that's one of those things. I want to share this another clip from this TED Talk that I thought was also super compelling, that speaks to the power of mirror neurons. It kind of reinforces what I just said about cinema.
How many of you have ever gone to a movie and cried, or gotten angry, or felt resolve at the end? Why did you? Because all you did was see something that you were not a part of, that you weren't in, and yet it affected you. That's called empathy. That's also mirror neurons. That's why they exist, because we are a social human creature who needs that connection with someone, something, a group of people. So when we see somebody do something, the mirror neurons send a message to our motor system that then creates a behavior within us.
It's also why televised athletics are so effective, right? I've been watching the NBA finals, and I've been really super fascinated by watching these teams play. And I start to feel like attached. You get emotionally attached to a team. So like if you are watching the Golden State Warriors and win yet again, I'm actually almost getting sick of them winning every time, but they're an incredible team. But it's why you feel like you're part of the team, right? When you watch that, you can rejoice with them when they win. It's why food commercials are so effective. It's watching someone eat something delicious, especially when you're hungry. It's super effective on the mirror neurons. So why am I talking about mirror neurons? What do mirror neurons have to do with empathy and with the superpower of empathy? Here's what it has to do with. User research. Why is it so important to observe a user using what you design, using your design, using a product? Why? Because you need to see their face so you can experience their pain. You can feel their pain and you can see it on their face. It's why video camera access is a critical feature for remote user testing as well. So that's another really important point I want to hit home with. We must tap into our empathy superpower to build effective products. And nobody really has done it better than IDEO. I mean, they are kind of the poster children, so to speak, of designing with empathy. And a couple of stories that I just love talking about from IDEO, one of them is the nursing tablet. So they were tasked with creating a tablet, like an iPad kind of device for nurses that could be used to record records, to keep records, document what's happening with patients. And originally the design was going to be operated with two hands, and it was going to be just like a typical iPad kind of thing, until they used their superpower of observation and observed these nurses in hospital rooms with expectant mothers who were having C-sections, maybe for their first one. And they noticed something that changed everything for them. And it was, again, the empathy and the observation that they had, the mirror neurons working here. They noticed that these mothers, they were so scared and nervous that when during the procedure, they would reach for the nurse's hand, and the nurse would hold the hand of the mother who was about to deliver. And that changed everything. They created a tablet that could be operated with one hand so that the nurse could have a free hand to comfort the mother. That's beautiful, right? And then another example with IDEO is the kid's toothbrush. I love this. So you know how if you have kids, you know how a lot of their toothbrushes, they aren't like ours. They aren't like adult toothbrushes that have the thin, kind of narrow plastic handles. Adults are very dexterous. We can kind of guide the brush in different angles and such. A lot more dexterous than kids. But with kids, what they noticed. And first of all, by the way, can you imagine IDEO calling you if you have kids and saying, hey, we want to do some research on your kids. We want to come into your home at night while your kids are in their pajamas and observe them brushing, watch them brush their teeth in the bathroom. Can you imagine that being a part of that research? Thankfully, there were enough parents that said yes, because what they noticed when these kids were brushing their teeth was that they fist the thing. They hold it in their fist. That's how they do it. And next time you watch your kids brushing their teeth, you'll see that. And so what did they do? They invented that fat handle toothbrush, that little cushy, rubbery kind of fat handle toothbrush. That was a design decision based on empathy. Right? So like, that's just another awesome example. And I love that IDEO, they said there's a user, there's an article on usertesting.com where I got these stories from. I'll be sure to link to it in the show notes. But the other thing that I took away from this story was the IDEO as an organization, they said, we can build anything. We can design anything. We even a rocket. They could design a rocket as long as they have the ability to observe the users, as long as they have an ability to get to know their users really well so they can exercise their empathy superpower in designing for them. That's it. That's really inspiring. That should inspire all of us. So I've been trying to get an internal product built for nearly 4 years now. Don't ask. And it finally got greenlit recently. The kicker? Due to a large business pivot on the IT side, the dev team has a very limited time window to build out the MVP. Well, thanks to Adobe XD, I already had the blueprints. I was able to quickly design, test, and gather feedback on my prototypes before the business decision was even made. So the next time your stakeholders or engineers like Howard Hughes say, "Show me all the blueprints," you can confidently fire up Adobe XD and say, "Here they are." Don't wait 4 years. Download XD for free and experience design already ahead of its time at userdefenders.com/XD. Another super inspiring story is by Doug Dietz, and it's about Doug Dietz, and he's honestly my favorite. This is one of my favorite stories of design. And if you listen to the show for any length of time, you know I mention him. I've mentioned him several times, but it never gets old to me. So I'll just touch on it briefly. Doug Dietz is a designer. He designed the MRI, the large MRI scanners that we know today that kind of look like a brick with a hole in them, kind of like the ones that haunt your dreams. If you've ever had an MRI before, there's a reason there's a panic button in there, because it's scary as heck, right? I mean, I've had MRIs, and I've had to hit the panic button about 5 minutes shy of my 45 minute scan. It's terrifying, right? So Doug Dietz works for he works for GE, but he works in the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. And he tells this story also on his TED Talk that he did, and we'll be sure to link to these things in the show notes. He tells this story of observing the first, and in the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, there's a lot of terminally ill children. It's super sad. And these kids have to get these scans all the time to see progress on the, a lot of them have cancer and various other illnesses. Again, many of them terminally ill. So he tells a story of the first time he unveiled, he was so proud of this design of his. But the first time he unveiled this MRI machine to a young patient, this little gal, and he observed her going into the room, and the room was already kind of dimly lit, and she was with her parents, but she was just terrified of this thing. She was just screaming and crying, and it broke his heart. It broke his heart to where he said, this is not good enough. And that's what I love about design, right? Like, we're designers because we believe we can make things better. And so Doug Dietz had the empathy. He used his mirror neurons. He used his empathy superpowers to observe this little girl in agony who was already suffering. And he came up with the GE MRI Discovery Series. It's incredible. And basically what he did was he and his team turned these sterile, scary environments into fun adventures like pirate ships and fun animated graphics all over the room and sounds. And it just, he completely revolutionized this experience for kids. And I think he brought the anesthesia rate, which is, you know, when you're a parent, you don't want your kid to get anesthetized, if that's the right way to say it, every time they go in to get an MRI. You do not want that. So he was able to bring the anesthesia rates down, I think from like 83% all the way down to like 23%, something around there. Incredible, right? And also it was so neat. Like he saw kids come out of this thing and ask their parents if they can come back tomorrow. I mean, that, if that doesn't touch your heart, right? So I want to share some snippets as well, some video clips and an audio. If you're listening on the podcast, I want to share this from him. I've never seen a designer cry and weep about their what they've created, what they've brought into the world until I saw this.
Hi, I'm Doug Dietz. I'm the principal designer for global design at GE Healthcare, and I'm the lead designer for Adventure Series. The Adventure Series is really an activity that we've been working on to see what can we do around our diagnostic imaging equipment to make it friendlier for both the family and for young patients. We have large diagnostic imaging equipment at GE Healthcare. They're huge, and some of them make noises. Adventure Series is really looking at it really from the child's perspective, looking at where their anxiety points are and coming up with some really nice solutions that help those, whether those are visually taking over the room in a theme, like a jungle theme or a pirate adventure or something, as well as music that leads them into the room and coloring books. But we wanted to have elements that addressed all the anxiety points.
My name's Liz Auer.
I'm Duncan Auer.
Where is this?
Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh.
Well, we're here today for a CT scan of Duncan's sinuses. He's had some really chronic congestion and coughing. So we're gonna have a look and see what's going on in there. And the pirate room was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The room was painted completely like a pirate setup, including the floor. The floor was like the dock with the water on the sides, and animals and things on the walls. And the CT scanner itself was like the wheel of a pirate ship. It's for a child, it can be kind of scary. You know, you see things that make noise and it look very institutional. You're not even really thinking about the fact that you're doing a procedure. Very, very welcoming, very whimsical and fun.
Why I really wrapped myself around this and tried my best to pull in some of the best people that I could to work with me is that I always kept in my mind that frightened child that was going through cancer or that was really having some problems going through their scan. And that is such a tough thing for a little one. And it's such a tough thing for a family. And I did put my heart and soul behind it. And it means a lot to me now that we have a solution and that the solution is helping the way it is and it's helping these families. And what a great thing to work for a huge company like GE, but show some passion like this that we can do something for people.
Another wonderful example is one I also talk about a lot on the show, and that's of Margaret Hamilton. Not the one who plays the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz, but the one who led the Apollo missions programming team. And who designed this error 1201-1202. She and her team coded this thing. There's pictures of her standing next to printouts of the code, all the code base that her and her team compiled during the missions. And it's so crazy to see. I'll try to link to it in the show notes. But the stack is taller than her, and she's probably a good 5'7" at least. The stack of papers of code is taller than her. It's just incredible. But I love that Margaret Hamilton had the empathy to create these subroutines, knowing that these computers can only process a limited, very, very limited amount of code at one time. So there's a lot more scientific explanation between the error of the error 1201 and 1202. And in fact, I'll let somebody else explain it better than me. Check this out.
What the executive effectively did was to run programs in their priority order. This kept resources clear for critical programs at critical moments. The drawback was that it was, to some extent, unpredictable. There was some concern that a bug or an unanticipated situation could make the computer unable to proceed. The solution was an auto restart function that could reboot the computer without the executive losing track of what it was supposed to be running. So what do those 1201 and 1202 program alarms have to do with any of this? As Apollo 11 was getting close to touching down on the moon, the rendezvous radar, not even in use at that time, was in a rare abnormal state that falsely made it pour bits into the computer at the maximum rate, wasting over 13% of the computer's time. The executive found that there were no more spaces in the computer to run new steps of essential programs. This triggered the 1201 alarm signaling executive overflow, no core sets, and the 1202 alarm signaling executive overflow, no VAC areas. These in turn triggered a software reboot, which was Lanning's failsafe. All jobs were canceled regardless of priority and then started again in priority order, quickly enough that no guidance or navigation data was lost. But it didn't clear up the issue. The computer was still overloaded by the same spurious radar data, stopping new program steps from running. In all, it triggered 4 1202 alarms and 1 1201 alarm. Eventually, Buzz Aldrin noticed that the 1202 came up when they entered the verb 16 noun 68, a program that would display the range to the landing site and the LM's velocity. The command itself didn't place a heavy load on the computer, but with the existing load, that extra bit of processing power seemed to trigger the 1202 alarm. Realizing this, the solution was simple. Ask Houston for the data instead of calling it up from the computer. Houston, as we know, gave Apollo 11 a go on all 5 1201 and 1202 alarms. If those alarms had been closer together, it could have wiped out navigation data during a reboot, but being separated by even a few seconds meant that the vital information was retained. It also helped that the spacecraft computer rebooted about 10,000 times faster than a desktop PC does now.
So these phones in our pockets, these phones are millions and millions of times faster than the computers powering what's the rockets that sent men to the moon. That's mind-blowing right there. Mind-blowing. Hundreds of millions of times. And so I just love that she had the empathy for these astronauts that if the computer should overload, that it would automatically, it would let them know, and it would automatically restart and save the data where they were at. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, she's an unsung hero for sure of the space program. But I love that story of empathy right there, especially from a developer point of view, because developers are designers too. That's a reality. They're designing code for users. So it's just another reminder. We all need to exercise our empathy superpower when we're creating for other humans. So I want to talk about how do we grow in empathy? Because some may feel like, well, I just don't have empathy. I'm just not a touchy-feely kind of person or a woo kind of, that's too woo for me or whatever. I don't think I could grow in my empathy. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And I want to tell you how you can do it. It can be learned. It can be taught. And you can grow in it. If you have a growth mindset, which I always say is critical for not just being a great designer, but being a great human. It is critical to have a growth mindset so you can grow and continue to learn. But you know what? Empathy is a choice. I always say this. Empathy is a choice that becomes easier to make the more we practice it. And you got to begin by having empathy for yourself. You can't give away what you don't already have. And I loved my episode with Seth Godin, and I'm going to share some snippets of him. And his episode was all about empathy. In fact, it was called Radical Empathy. Highly recommend checking that out if you haven't heard it. But here's a few snippets of Seth explaining empathy. Here's one right here.
It's very hard to be a lifeguard if you're wearing heavy boots. Because as soon as you jump in the water, you start sinking. And so it's really difficult for you to offer help to the person who's drowning. That what it means to be a lifeguard is A, you need to find someone who wants to get rescued. And B, you have to have enough confidence in where you are that you can help them.
I love that he said that. He says, you know, if you're a lifeguard, you can't rescue somebody if you're wearing heavy boots. That's a lifeguard that doesn't have empathy for themselves. That's not building themselves up. Right. And it's what I always say is you can't pour an empty vessel into another. It doesn't work that way. You got to fill your cup before you can actually pour into an empty one. So and I love the oxygen mask analogy to kind of bring another aviation analogy into this. When you're on an aircraft, right, you're getting ready to travel up into the air. What do the obligatory PSAs, right? The flight attendants do the obligatory PSA that only Southwest Airlines can make even remotely interesting. What do they say? They always say, in case of loss of cabin pressure, these weird masks will fall from the ceiling. And here's what you do first, right? And parents always kind of know, they're talking to parents. They say, before you help your child, what do you have to do? You put your oxygen mask on first. Why? Because you can't help others if you're dead. You can't help anyone if you can't help yourself first. So I really strongly believe that that has a lot to do with empathy, has a lot to do with our personal growth journey. And I'll touch briefly. I started a personal growth journey in 2015, just before starting this show. In fact, this show is a result, a direct result from my personal growth journey. I started this show and it was really a result of me actually waking up one day and going, I'm going to get better. It's been 40 years and I've really lost track of the putting my own oxygen mask on first. And as a result, I was a grumpy, just tired, irritable, bitter jerk. And I'm going to be honest with you. I wasn't a pleasant person to be around. Ask my wife. No. No, but seriously though, I realized this and what I did was I started actually taking care of myself. I started waking up early for myself first, putting my oxygen mask on first. A lot of us, we wake up for other people. We wake up for our employers, right? We wake up for our family. Nothing wrong with that. But if you don't have a full cup, you're not going to have much to pour into others. You're not going to be fit for service. I always think about the analogy, like when I see somebody broken down on the side of the road and they got their hazards on and they're like trying to move their car themselves, I will try to make sure I pull over somewhere and I get out and I help them push the car out of the way. And hopefully my son or some other strong folks will be with me to help out with that. But I'll be honest with you, like there's times, and I live in the Rocky Mountains, so it's 6,000 feet above sea level here, and the oxygen is thinner, even though it's fresher, it's thinner. But there's been times when I've helped push somebody's car, and I'll be honest with you, I thought I was going to die because my oxygen. So that's another analogy, a reinforcement. It's like we need to be fit for service. That goes right into empathy. We need to be fit to serve others, and that is everything. So, personal growth. I highly, highly recommend. Jim Rohn says your level of success will seldom exceed your level of personal growth. So there's something there too. And then Seth Godin, one other thing he said too is he kind of said something really eye-opening to me. He said, faked empathy is just as good as real empathy. And I said, what? And I said, can you explain that? Because that's kind of perplexing to me. And he explained it really well. Check this out.
I don't think you have to be in a wheelchair to design a hotel room that someone in a wheelchair can use. And that person who designed the hotel room may not care about you one bit. They might just be a professional. And to be a professional means to act as if. The surgeon who took your appendix out didn't show up and say, oh, I can't do it. I'm not really in a good mood. I don't really feel like doing surgery today. No, you don't care. You just want the surgeon to show up and do what she said she would do. That's what a professional would do. You know, if we think about the absurdity of major league sports, the players act like they care about the team. But as soon as they get traded, suddenly they care about a different team because they're professionals. And so I'm not arguing that you need to actually wake up in the middle of the night in cold sweats because you care so much about that human being you're exerting emotional labor for. I'm arguing that if you're a professional, it's your job. The ditch digger's job is to dig a ditch, and your job is to act as if. And if you can 100% fake the empathy, that's as good as actually being empathetic as far as I'm concerned.
Another thing that Seth said was he when I asked him about being indispensable in this artificially intelligent world, was it gives us empathy gives us a really competitive edge in this ever increasingly artificially intelligent world. So check it out. When I asked him about being indispensable, which he wrote a book called Lynchpin, which is awesome, about being indispensable in our work. And I asked him that. I said, how do you stay indispensable in this artificially intelligent world? And check out his answer.
That's a great question. You know, in 1917, I was on this podcast and they asked me about the jackhammer. And they said, you know, the jackhammer is coming. What will that do to the people who have to dig up streets? And I point out that most people who dig up streets are saying, well, they'll just work harder at digging up streets and they're not worried about the jackhammer, which of course is absurd. Lots and lots of people with pickaxes got put out of work over the course of decades because why would you hire a guy with a pickaxe if you could use a jackhammer? Well, if you're a radiologist, you need to accept the fact that a computer can read an X-ray better than you now and multiply that times 1,000. If I can write down what you do, if I can write down the steps, I can get a computer to do it better than you. So the only plan is to do a job where you can't write down the steps. That's it. You need to do jobs where you can't write down the steps. And if you have a job where you do write down the steps, hire someone cheaper than you to do those steps so you can go back to doing a job where you can't write down the steps.
Do work where you can't write down the steps. That sounds like a lot more soft skills, doesn't it? Sounds like a lot more stepping out of the comfort zone and serving people as humans in a human way. If there's steps that can be written down, then if you do something where anybody can emulate it or do it, you might be out of a job in the next 5-10 years. You never know. Or you might be just doing something else that you really didn't plan on doing. So that's just another kind of neat piece of advice there. So I'm just going to conclude here. You know, I think I've made a pretty good case, strong case for empathy and why it's an imperative superpower in designing products for other humans or services. It's just a critical soft skill. I mean, it's UX, as my friend Nick Fink says, former guest on the show, he says UX is not just confined to the four corners of the screen, right? It's not. I mean, we're creating UX all the time. It's on the freeway. I mean, right? You get these drivers and I mean, that can be the most unpleasant user experience ever, right? Or traffic. Right? Or on an airplane, there's another aviation call. So, and you'll know this when you see the parents who let their kids use their tablets without the headphones on, you know who you are. In line at the grocery store. Hey, what if we put our phones away and actually talk to the person behind us every once in a while? That's one of my empathy challenges that I want to share with you. I'll get to that in a little bit, but there's some really interesting interactions that can take place and also empathy building that takes place when we actually put our phones away, our devices. There's something called the iPhone effect. If you Google that, you'll see it's even the presence, the visible presence of a phone, even if it's upside down in a meeting, the visible presence of a phone has scientifically shown to decrease our levels of empathy. So, hey, You know, as hard as it, I love my phone. I love it and I'm addicted to it. But as hard as it is, I think we're going to be better when we master it, because technology is an incredible servant, but a terrible master. So, you know, it's really, again, I just want to reiterate that. Here's one of my bigger points here. If you don't care or even want to try to feel the pain of your users are feeling, please stop designing for humans immediately. And if you're a designer and referring to the humans you're designing for as users makes you feel less empathy for them, also, please stop. Stop designing for humanity immediately. I might have just opened up a can of worms. Maybe that's another monologue episode. I don't know. You tell me. Let me know on Twitter at UserDefenders. And if there's other subject matters you'd like me to tackle in a monologue format like this for season 7, I would love to hear about it. So again, reiterating, every life-changing product or service that's ever been built had radical empathy at the core of it. So before I sign off, I kind of touched on this a little bit, but I actually put something together, was with Seth Godin's release. I was able to launch this, and I've been working on this for nearly 3 years. And these are all stories. These are things that I've done, that I've tried, and it's called the Empathy Challenge. And you can sign up for it. You go to userdefenders.com/empathy. There'll be a link in the show notes, but that's pretty easy to remember. userdefenders.com/empathy. You can get in there and basically you just sign up for it. It's an email that will arrive in your inbox one every week for 7 weeks. So I originally designed these as being 7 challenges in 1 week. And then I realized that's way too much for people to ask of people to do, because some of them do require being in the right context. So I changed it to where you get 1 challenge every week. So it's still, I can still not have to change the name of it. It's 1 week, the Strong Empathy Challenge. But again, these are exercises. These are things that I've tried and that have proven that they've grown my empathy levels so much. And I know they'll do the same for you if you complete each of these challenges. Check it out. It arrives conveniently into your inbox. And I'd love to have you do that. And the reason I'm doing this now is there's kind of a selfish reason for it. I really see the lack of empathy that's taking place in our culture with our young people. Young people are growing up with these devices. They're growing up in the digital age. And I know I'm going to sound like an old curmudgeon. And I got no problem with them. I work in technology. I love my phone. But I honestly believe that these phones, and especially social media, is not helping us grow in our empathy. In fact, it's actually taking away from our empathy for other humans. And it's taking away our ability to effectively communicate with other human beings. So that's kind of my little soapbox. Apart from even just the design aspect, I just feel like we are just losing something here. And I think we need to say enough is enough and start taking it back. So that's the reason. That there's a selfish reason here in me doing an episode like this and doing the empathy challenge. So that's it, really. And again, I always say that being a great designer begins and ends with being a great human. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for checking this out. I'm so thrilled to be able to serve you in this way. And again, let me know what you thought of this on Twitter. I'm at UserDefenders. And check out the Empathy Challenge, userdefenders.com/empathy. And last but not least, I just want to say, fight on, my friends.